you're sort of burning out roof rafters to stay warm. You can only do that for so long, and pretty soon you run out of roof rafters.
Governor Bill Walker makes the case for his budget plan. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, January 18th. Good evening, I'm Laurie Townsend. Also tonight, John Sturgeon's challenge of National Park Service authority goes to the U.S. Supreme Court.
A moose hunter going to Washington, D.C. in front of the U.S. Supreme Court, it's actually pretty incredible.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
The Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
And by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
Well, we're here. After months of public debate, lawmakers will gavel in tomorrow in Juneau to begin fashioning a solution to the state's budget crisis. With oil dipping ominously below $30 a barrel, Alaska faces a deficit of at least $3.5 billion, or two-thirds the general fund budget. Governor Bill Walker says the state must change how it does business. He argues it's time for Alaska to tap its enormous savings accounts. As APRN's Rachel Waldholtz explains, the governor's plan would fundamentally reshape the state's relationship with oil.
Walker says Alaska always knew this day was coming.
Everybody knew we would get here at some point.
Here being the day when crude doesn't cover our costs. For decades, Alaska's budget has followed the rise and fall of oil. Big budgets in boom years, big cuts during the inevitable bust. But with oil production declining, Walker argues Alaska faces a new reality. Even if the price recovers, it's not clear that revenue will. And with oil down, earnings on the state's savings are now Alaska's single largest source of income. Last year, lawmakers pieced together a budget by cutting infrastructure projects and dipping into savings, but Walker says that's not sustainable.
We're sort of burning our roof rafters to stay warm. You can only do that for so long, and pretty soon you run out of roof rafters.
So the governor has put forward a proposal that he hopes will get Alaska off the oil price roller coaster. Attorney General Craig Richards was tasked with building the plan. He compares the current system to a dysfunctional household.
It's like if you have a husband and a wife, and one of them was a gambler for a living, and one of them had a steady job. What we've been doing as a state of Alaska is we have been living day to day on the gambler's salary, and we have been saving the steady state income salary.
In other words, the state has been funding basic operations, everything from education to snowplows, off unpredictable oil taxes. Meanwhile, the relatively steady earnings from the state's $50 billion permanent fund have remained off limits. About half the fund's earnings are saved, while the other half is paid out in dividends. Walker and Richards want to turn the current model on its head. They'd use the fund earnings to pay for government while setting aside some oil revenue for dividends.
Why this is a game changer is that it takes oil price volatility out of our state budget and our economy, and it puts it into our savings account.
The plan would dump most of the state's oil taxes and royalties into the permanent fund. It would also pull about $3 billion from the Constitutional Budget Reserve, the state's rainy day fund. Oil prices could go up, they could go down, but the fund would serve as a cushion and act as a kind of endowment, generating a steady income for the state. Call it Alaska's retirement account. We've been setting aside a portion of our paycheck for 40 years. Now that paycheck isn't coming anymore, Richard says, and it's time to switch gears and start living off the savings.
To me, the question has never been, are we one day going to spend the permanent fund to support state government? It's, is today the right time?
The administration's answer is an emphatic yes. The catch, of course, if the permanent fund earnings are used for state government, they can't be used for the PFD. Instead, the plan would devote half the state's royalties to a separate fund to pay dividends. That would cut the PFD in half next year to about $1,000. It's not far off the historical average, but if oil production continues to decline, then the dividend would drop with it. Richards and Walker argue that if the state keeps burning through its savings, there won't be anything left for dividends anyway.
So if we do nothing, the dividend disappears in 5 years.
Bottom line, Richard says, he sees no way to solve the budget crisis without tapping the permanent fund, whether it's the governor's plan or something else. Say, for instance, lawmakers cut $1 billion from the budget, a huge lift. Add in an aggressive income tax, which might raise $500 million. A major sales tax could bring in another $500 million, he says.
Any one of those things would be a major accomplishment. So the idea that you could do all of them is pretty out there. And it only gets you more than, you know, slightly more than halfway to the solution.
Of course, the governor's plan isn't a full solution either. The administration estimates that replumbing the permanent fund could generate about $3.3 billion a year, while still maintaining and inflation-proofing the fund's principal. That still leaves a billion-dollar hole. To close the gap, the administration is proposing a slew of new taxes, including the first income tax since 1980. The governor's plan would also raise about $500 million from the oil industry. And it would cut about $100 million from state agencies. That's a tall order anytime, and this is an election year. From the Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholz in Anchorage.
Governor Bill Walker is in Juneau preparing for tomorrow's start to the legislative session. Regardless of other considerations, the big challenge will be finding common ground with lawmakers over how to fix the state's large and growing budget deficit. In a conversation this morning, Governor Walker says the longer the state waits, the more challenging solving the problem becomes.
You know, some believe that the price of oil will bounce up, back up again, and that will save the day. I'm not one of those. I'm concerned. I believe those that say we're going to be at this price of oil for some time going forward. Sanctions just coming off of Iran, that'll release another 500,000 barrels a day of oil into the world market. So, you know, waiting will cost us significantly. The longer we wait, the more dollars we spend draw down on savings, and it begins to reach a point that some of our options go away of how to sort of resolve this problem as we continue to spend more of our savings.
Republican lawmakers have talked about the need to make deeper cuts. Are there any state services or state programs that you think should really be off the table?
Well, we, you know, I think that there will be discussion of additional cuts. What I hope doesn't happen is that while we're sort of wrestling over $100 million here, $100 million there, we still have a $3.5 billion deficit. And so we need to make sure that we're putting the appropriate emphasis on the solution. Cuts will be part of that. Reductions will certainly be part of that. Will that balance the budget? Absolutely not. And as we know, if we laid off every state employee, it would not put much of a dent in the deficit. So it's much bigger than that.
But are there programs or certain services that you think just shouldn't be part of the mix for cuts?
I think we'll see pretty much everything on the table this session, as far as on both cuts as well as on the income side. So,
Governor, you campaigned as a bipartisan or nonpartisan candidate during your first year in office. You've frustrated both Republican and Democratic lawmakers. Are you going to approach this session any differently in terms of how you relate to lawmakers?
Well, I think differently might be, I think things are different based upon the circumstances that we have. And I think we're a different set of circumstances than before. I think last year we were headed this way. Nobody knew if it was really going to get as bad as it is now. And now we're here. I don't think there's any question about that. So I think that actually being a nonpartisan governor is going to be an advantage to me, because it's not like I'm picking sides based upon my party affiliation, trying to sort of draw people over onto my side of the line, so to speak. I don't have any lines, and I don't have a party. So I think that it in some respects, it's going to be easier. It will be easier for me in this session to deal with some of these issues, because they're not partisan issues. Really, they're just Alaskan issues.
Governor, your plan includes a lot of new taxes on various industries, an increase in the minimum oil tax, the first state income tax in 35, almost 36 years now. Many lawmakers are resistant to taxes. How do you plan to get past that resistance?
Well, I'm resistant to taxes. I don't like taxes either. What I dislike more than taxes is drawing down $400,000 an hour is what our deficit is. So that we need to be aware of. You know, we need to remember that, you know, right now, you know, Alaska has the lowest personal taxes in the nation, as far as certainly always on the personal tax, and we pay out a dividend. And if this plan is adopted in its entirety, we'll still be in the second lowest personal income taxes or taxation or personal level in the nation, as well as still having an annual dividend.
A big part of your plan is a major overhaul of oil tax credits. You'd raise about $500 million by replacing some existing tax credits with a loan fund and raising the minimum tax. Do you worry about the impact on the oil industry with prices so low?
Well, I worry about the impact on Alaska with prices so low. Our credit program is the most aggressive in the nation. And that was instituted at a time when prices of oil were much, much higher. And we just can't afford that anymore. That's one of the programs that we just can't afford. I know, and meeting with each of the companies, we met with the independents, and they also understand that. They'd love to get us, you know, would like us to pay the credits that we're paying. But they recognize that we just can't do that. We were on track for the credit program. Next year was on track to be over $1 billion in the credit program. That's pretty tough to justify when our revenues are this low.
Governor Bill Walker speaking from Juneau. Throughout the week, we'll hear from legislative leaders regarding their ideas for balancing the budget. Bethel's Pete Kaiser has won the Kuskokwim 300 for the second year in a row. Last year, he became the first local musher to win the race in nearly 30 years. Kaiser dashed across the finish line shortly after 11 o'clock on Sunday morning.
Probably one of the tougher courses I've ever seen, and so a lot of challenges, but it's good to be here.
Due to warmer weather in the weeks leading up to the race, the course had little ice.
I think just the amount of ice with the wind and the bare ground around Whitefish, it was really challenging. A lot of open water. It was interesting.
Kaiser will go home with the $25,000 first place award. Reigning Yukon Quest champion Brent Sass of Eureka came in second, followed by Norwegian musher Jor Liseth Olsen. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, remembering longtime Alaska economist and policy advisor Arlen Tusin.
He really taught me that true genius are people who can see patterns that other people can't see, that look unrelated, but they actually exist.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your friends, family, and neighbors at Raven, Alaska, connecting over 100 communities across the state. Find out more at flyraven.com. And by
the 2016 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. Teacher nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com.
A dispute between an Alaska boater and the National Park Service will be heard by the highest court in the country on Wednesday. As KOAC's Dan Bross reports, lower courts have rejected Anchorage resident John Sturgeon's suit, challenging Park Service authority to regulate Alaska rivers where they pass through federal conservation units.
John Sturgeon's journey to the Supreme Court started during a September 2007 trip in the Yukon-Charley Rivers National Preserve, where he says he's long hunted moose.
Out of Eagle on the Yukon River since 1971. I've hunted every year there consecutively since that time, and so just the area I've always hunted.
Sturgeon recounts being stopped on the banks of the Nation River in the preserve, making repairs to a small hovercraft, when park rangers showed up and informed him hovercraft are illegal to operate in federal parks and preserves.
I never thought, never dreamed that I'd, because of that incident, be standing in front of the U.S. Supreme Court, the highest court in the land, and kind of a moose hunter going to Washington, D.C. in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. It's actually pretty incredible.
Sturgeon challenged the hovercraft ban, contending that Alaska's navigable waters are state-owned and do not fall under federal jurisdiction. Sturgeon describes his argument, which is backed by the state of Alaska, as about government overreach and violation of the 1980 Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, or ANILCA, that created numerous Alaska parks and preserves.
There's language, for example, that, you know, mandate that motorized boats are allowed, that you have snow machine access, that hunting is allowed. Subsistence is going to be encouraged.
Legally, the case boils down to a single section of ANILCA, 103C. It says non-federal land within a conservation unit is not subject to rules meant solely for the surrounding federal lands. To Sturgeon, it's straightforward. State property is exempt from Park Service rules, but lower courts have read it to mean that state land is exempt only from Alaska-specific park rules. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals concluded the hovercraft ban applies because it's a nationwide rule, not crafted just for an Alaska park. The broader issue of who controls river waters is also complicated.
Neither the state nor the federal government owns the water overlying the state-owned submerged lands. The water is actually subject to both state and federal jurisdiction.
Katie Strong is an attorney with Trustees for Alaska, which is representing numerous conservation groups as friends of the court in the Sturgeon case. ANILCA specifics aside, Strong underlines that the case is about more than one person's hunting tradition.
While Mr. Sturgeon is only one hovercraft user, multiple people could be using hovercrafts in a popular park like Denali that really impacts the visitor experience.
Sturgeon agrees that the case isn't just about him, but holds firm on Alaskans' right to freely ply state waterways, even where they traverse federal parks and preserves.
This is a 100% public interest lawsuit. It's not something that if I win, I'm not going to get a citation or get my fine back or something.
Sturgeon will be in Washington, D.C. for Wednesday's Supreme Court hearing. His attorneys have been there for a week preparing. Sturgeon's case has made it further than that of another Alaska boater who challenged NPS authority on Alaska rivers. Central resident Jim Wild unsuccessfully appealed federal misdemeanor charges stemming from a 2010 run-in with Yukon Charley Preserve rangers trying to conduct a boat safety check. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
As you just heard, the Sturgeon case that will be argued in the U.S. Supreme Court this week is about hovercraft and whether the Park Service can ban them from rivers flowing through Alaska's national parks and preserves. But the case has alarmed a lot of people with no interest in hovercraft. It also splits Alaska Native stakeholders. Some subsistence advocates say a decision for Sturgeon could threaten subsistence rights, while Native corporations say if the Park Service wins, it could cripple their ability to develop their own lands. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
Aside from the actual parties, that is, John Sturgeon and the National Park Service, 10 other groups have written briefs telling the Supreme Court how much they have riding on the case. Chief among them, the state of Alaska, which is backing Sturgeon. Longstanding federal law says states own the land under navigable waters, like the Nation River, where park rangers confronted Sturgeon. Governor Bill Walker says the feds shouldn't infringe on state sovereignty.
Our waterways are our waterways. What's under our waterways is our land and whatnot. So it's an important case.
The state's lawyers argue that because the state owns the riverbed, it also has the power to regulate what happens in the waters above. And the governor says river transportation is vital.
When half of your state or over half, 60% of your state is we're having challenges getting access to, that's a pretty significant handicap we have. So really that has a lot to do with access to me.
Two coalitions of Native corporations are also supporting Sturgeon. 18 million acres of the land within Alaska's federal conservation units are Native corporation in holdings. These are islands of private land within the borders of parks and preserves. Lower court rulings in favor of the feds would allow the Park Service to impose a lot of its regulations on these inholdings.
This was never part of the deal of ANILCA.
That's Doyon CEO Aaron Schutt referring to the landmark 1980 law that expanded parks and refuges across Alaska. Schutt says Doyon, the Native Corporation for the Interior, has about 2 million acres within federal conservation units.
We are in holders only because these conservation units were placed around our lands. We were not in holders in our own country in Interior Alaska by choice.
ANILCA is a package of compromises, and Schutt says if the Park Service wins, it would undo the law's key promise to inholders.
The deal was we would be able to have economic development, hunting and fishing opportunities free from national conservation unit regulations.
But the way the lower courts interpreted a key paragraph of ANILCA in favor of the Park Service, the agency's power would spread well beyond rivers onto Native corporation and state inholdings.
That's what's most problematic, and that's what got people very concerned and frankly alarmed.
Attorney John Katchen filed a brief supporting Sturgeon on behalf of Alaska's congressional delegation.
Right now, they haven't done this, but the Park Service has the authority to say to a Native corporation, you can't build a lodge on your land. You can't build a trail. You can't do berry picking. You can't land a plane. If the Ninth Circuit's decision and Sturgeon doesn't get overturned, they will have that authority.
The concern that the Park Service would extend its reach is not just hypothetical. Last year, the Park Service proposed new national oil and gas regulations. The agency wrote that they'd apply to non-federal land within park boundaries in Alaska, too, because the Ninth Circuit's ruling against Sturgeon allows it. Most of the friend of the court briefs are stacked up on Sturgeon's side. But conservation groups wrote one supporting the Park Service. So did attorney Bob Anderson on behalf of subsistence users. Anderson, who represented Elder Katie John in a milestone subsistence case, says if Sturgeon wins, the federal subsistence priority disappears for rivers across the state.
If those arguments are taken at face value and endorsed by the Supreme Court, that could result in the overturning of the Katie John decision, which the Native community has fought for over 25 years.
Anderson says the court's decision should only affect rivers, not land, and he doesn't think the state's ownership of the river beds gives it final say in activity above them.
Yes, absolutely. The state has a presumptive ownership of submerged land, the actual bed and banks of the river, but that doesn't mean that they own the water column.
Sturgeon and his allies say the court can decide this case in favor of Sturgeon without touching the Katie John decision because subsistence has special significance in Anilka. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment. On the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins lead to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
An economist who played an important role in the shaping of modern Alaska has passed away. Dr. Arlen Tusing began his work in Alaska at the University of Alaska Fairbanks Department of Economics in 1965. He was later affiliated with the Institute of Social and Economic Research and advised the director of the U.S. Geological Survey. Economist John Tahotsky says Tusing was an economist for the U.S. Senate Committee on Interior and Insular Affairs in the early 1970s, when it was chaired by Senator Scoop Jackson of Washington. There, Tahotsky says, Tusing had a hand in major legislation affecting Alaska's vast land base, including the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act and the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, or ANILCA.
He was part of a group known in Alaska, known as Scoop's Troops, and they were involved in ANCSA legislation, ANILCA, the original precursors to the ANILCA legislation.
Tusing also worked on legislation authorizing the creation of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline and helped evaluate damages after the Exxon Valdez oil spill in 1989. He later became a consultant to the energy industry, where Tahotsky says Tusing played an influential role in the restructuring of U.S. natural gas development and marketing.
Mid-70s, people thought there was no gas. They thought the world was running out of natural gas. He basically, through the process of deregulation, industry had the incentive to look for gas. And, of course, there was plenty of gas to find.
Tusing was author, co-author, or editor of more than 300 books and publications. Arlen Tusing died Friday night at the age of 82. Four tribes in western Alaska are calling on the Association of Village Council Presidents to broaden the focus of a special meeting originally intended to address regional governance and to set a date for the gathering. KNBA's Jacqueline Estes reports.
On January 8th, KYUK in Bethel reported it had obtained documents showing AVCP used grants for temporary assistance for needy families to keep a vocational flight school going. In December, AVCP laid off 30 employees, 7% of its workforce, citing budget troubles. AVCP also announced a 5% pay cut for general staff and a 10% salary reduction for senior management. Mike Williams Sr. with the Akiak Tribal Council says the sudden layoffs may enable to pay for stove fuel or electricity.
Yeah, the majority of those live in Bethel, and a lot of those are also in the villages. So they're left out in the cold. You know, we're very concerned about that.
William says the tribes of Akiak, Akiachuk, Kwikluk, and Tuluksak, along with several others along the Yukon River, want to find out more than they've been told.
And I think in that meeting that we can close the door and find out what, really is going on.
Last year, the regional for-profit corporation Chelista created a group to study problems with legislation affecting Alaska Native people and organizations. The group came up with three proposals to strengthen AVCP, to create a borough, or to create a new regional tribal government. William says the goal is to give Natives a stronger voice.
And if there is development, for instance, the Donlin Gold project, then how are we going to be have the ability to do some regulation? And also the issue of taxing came up as well.
In an October meeting, tribal representatives voted to hold a special meeting on governance in February. AVCP is the regional nonprofit for the 56 villages in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jocelyn Estes.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at alaskapublic.org. You can also find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media, or you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Rachel Waldholz and Jocelyn Estes in Anchorage, Lakeed Rashavis in Bethel, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Artists make us think and question. They excite and engage. Artists inspire Alaska. The 2016 Rasmussen Foundation Individual Artist Awards Grant Program is now accepting applications. Individual Artist Awards support Alaska artists in 10 creative disciplines at all career stages. The program is open to Alaska residents only. For details and to apply, visit rasmussen.org/IAA. The deadline is March 1, 2016. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
It's as easy as 1, 2, 3. 1, file your 2016 PFD application today. 2, receive a confirmation of filing. And 3, sign electronically with your secure My Alaska account. Visit pfd.alaska.gov for more information. And remember, the deadline to apply is Thursday, March 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.